Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. One thing that's become very clear in the past few years is that celebrity partnerships in alcohol don't really work. Not unless the celebrity has some very deep link with the brand, maybe like Kylie does with her wines or George Clooney did with his tequila. So I was interested to hear that Carlsberg, one of the biggest beer companies in the world, had decided to partner their premium beer 1664 with actor Robert Pattinson. The partnership launches in the first quarter of 2026, and I wanted to know why and how Carlsberg were going to make sure it was meaningful. Siva Nikolaev, the global vice president of premium brands, spoke to me in December 2025 from their Copenhagen offices and explained not just the strategy, but how it had come about. The conversation then moved into maybe what was more a surprising and revealing direction, into flavours and how flavour preferences change by market. This is a conversation I might revisit in a year to see how it all went. In the meantime, if you want to know more, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter at drinksinsider.com. Thank you very much for joining me this morning. Can you tell me something about what you do at Carlsberg?
Yeah, of course. So I'm posted in Copenhagen and I look after the overall premiumization agenda at Carlsberg Group and after the global premium brands, 1664
being one of them. Okay, so how many brands altogether do you look after?
There would be five. That includes Tuborg, 1664, Grimbergen, and Brooklyn.
Okay, so let's talk about 1664. Can you tell me a bit about the beer and something about its heritage and where it sits in the market?
Sure, great pleasure. This is a French beer that originates from France. Interestingly, it's been created to a very special occasion. I don't know if you know that. It's been created to the coronation of the Queen Elizabeth in 1952. So it's been created for a very special occasion in France. And basically the brand stands for everything that France and French culture has to give to the world. Refined taste, sophistication, being rooted in culture.
Okay, so it's definitely, I mean, premium beer is one of the brightest spots in the beer market at the moment, and that's definitely a premium beer. But the reason that we're speaking this morning is you've got a new celebrity ambassador, which is Robert Pattinson. Can you talk about what made you decide that a beer with this kind of heritage needed more than traditional beer marketing?
It's a very particular beer, I must say. So if you haven't done so, I encourage you to try it. It's surprisingly smooth and with a very unique citrus twist. And it's being sold in a blue bottle, which is very unusual for the beer category overall. It's a premium beer in a lot of markets, actually. Probably the most premium beer you can find. So it's always been a bit apart of the rest of the category. It's a bit special and super premium. So we wanted to challenge the norms and what beer advertising and beer marketing can be. And in that sense, partnering with a celebrity and an actor like Robert Pattinson was a
and
was
why
the right
him?
Move,
what's the audience segment that you're trying to target?
We are targeting people who appreciate and celebrate refined taste, good taste and refined things in life. Those who like culture and those who are into art and kind of cultural exploration. So in that sense, it was very, very crucial that we have an ambassador or the voice for the brand who is kind of the right embodiment for the brand. And Robert Pattinson is one of them. He's someone who reflects well the values of the brand. He stands for modern expression of good taste. He's self-assured. He's discerning and at the same time a little inspected, and his career choices kind of project confidence and also individuality. He's been exploring different avenues. He's been with Hollywood blockbusters, but also indie movies. So he's clearly someone that reflects really well and an apologetic modern good taste.
So I'm really really interested in this. Across the drinks category, we've seen some celebrity partnerships which have done brilliantly, some of which have done less brilliantly. And I know that people are really interested in how this actually works. So when you're thinking about a celebrity partnership like this, can you talk me through the sort of decisions that you make? Do you sit with a wall of photos in front of you and go, this guy, yes, this guy, absolutely not? And then how do you approach them and get them on board?
The key is that there is this authentic fit between the brand values and what the brand stands for and the personality of the of a celebrity. So it has to be there. So it has to be authentic. And when it comes to approaching a person, he has to be genuinely interested. So it doesn't become just kind of celebrity slapping or like something transactional. There has to be an authentic fit between the brand and the celebrity, and the celebrity has to be genuinely engaged and interested in this collaboration. This is the recipe for success, and this is the recipe for an authentic, engaging, culturally meaningful
marketing.
But I mean,
what does it take? Do you go to their agents and say, you know, we'd like you to do this, or what's actually the process of engaging a celebrity?
Yeah, you approach his team, and then later on himself. You present to them the brand, you pitch to them what the brand stands for, what it stands in, for in the lives of consumers. And then if there is a genuine interest or first interest, then you discuss the collaboration itself, the campaign that you want to introduce, and the role of the celebrity in creating and designing the whole campaign.
And how did you get him involved? Did you bring him to Copenhagen and give him a trip through the brewery? Or I mean, how involved was he right from the beginning?
Robert Pattinson has a very busy schedule, so unfortunately he wasn't able to come to Copenhagen and to meet us in person. So we communicated on Teams and online, but we had quite a few conversations with him, and he had a very big say in developing the campaign. He was actively participating in designing and in the discussions about the creative side of the campaign. So you could say it was a very meaningful, active contribution from himself.
Okay, obviously we're on a podcast where people are listening, not seeing, but can you describe what the campaign is? How are you going to use Robert Pattinson?
Well, I have to keep a little bit of a suspense because I can't... The premiere of the campaign will be later in quarter one, so I want to reveal all of that. That is to say, we want the brand to stand for an apologetic good taste. We want to embrace the differences of good taste and what the shapes and form the good taste could take. And Robert Pattinson and all that does what he does the best. He acts.
All right. So you're going to launch it. How are you going to measure whether it's been successful or not? What's the scale? What do you do to go, yes, this worked really well?
Well, this is the first time we have that kind of partnership, a partnership of that size and caliber. So we want to go wide. We go after fame, first of all, and reach as many drinkers as we can. We know for a fact that 1664 Blanc, the product itself, has the highest repurchase rate amongst all our brands. So once consumer try, they buy it again. So that's why we want to have a quite broad reach for this campaign. When it comes to the brand itself, we want to play a culturally meaningful role in consumers' lives. We want to own the debate about what good taste is in the modern culture and the society. And that kind of resonance and the amplification of this worldwide discourse is the primary KPI for this campaign. Then obviously there are equity KPIs in business.
That is so interesting. Tell me more about the discussion about good taste.
Well, you could argue in this world, the society is quite torn apart. It's hard to agree on a lot of things, particularly on what good taste is. So there are so many expressions of good taste, and we want to encourage consumers to stand for what they believe is a good taste and own that worldwide debate about it. So that's kind of the cultural role of the brand to embody the good taste. Okay, and spark interesting. Debate about
all it. Right. So one of the things about celebrities being involved in alcohol brands is like I said, some of them worked really well. And typically when the celebrity has either been the conceiver of the brand, like, I don't know, George Clooney, I nearly forgot his name, or in the UK, you get somebody like Kylie Minogue, who's working very, who clearly loves her own brand, and then you've got other celebrity brands that fizzle and die because basically the person is under contract and they do an Instagram post a week and they're not fully engaged in their own brand. So how engaged is he going to be, and how are you going to like how is that going to work? How are you going to get over the problem of celebrities who didn't come up with the brand idea? They're there on contract. How are you going to get him excited about it?
Well, as I said already in the first stages of our collaboration, he was very engaged personally. He had a say in the campaign, and we discussed in quite detail and quite nuances about the campaign and what we're going to change and how we want to do that. So the engagement so far was very high. And to the benefits of the final product, of course. And then throughout the launch of the campaign, he will be present in certain events. He will be part of the PR plan and will be a voice for the brand once we launch it globally, once we will unfold it across.
Okay, so let's talk about the brand itself. What are the key markets for this beer?
It's a truly global brand. So it's present in Asia, Eastern and Western Europe. It's quite big in China, in Asia overall. We have quite... a lot of big markets in Western world, like UK, Denmark, all the Scandinavian markets, France, obviously as well. And then in Eastern Europe, it's particularly big in
Ukraine. That's interesting. How do you supply the Ukrainian market at the moment? Is it brewed locally or do you ship it in by truck?
It's brewed locally, yes.
Okay.
No, it's brewed locally.
Can you give me some idea of the volume of it?
Well, we don't disclose it officially, but it's a
Okay. And you said that it has a very high repurchase. How do you know?
Well, this is what the FMCG companies do. We have shopper panels and consumer panels, and we can track quite precisely once it was purchased once, whether the same household has purchased for the second time. And we have the metrics and action standards for what good repurchase rate is. And as I mentioned, 1664 Blanc scores above all brands within Carlsberg Group on that metric. So there is something about the taste that's worth trying.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the beer category. So like the rest of the alcohol category, beer is not doing as well as it did. Can you talk about the difference between the premium beer category and how that's doing compared to, say, the more everyday beers? Can you just sort of outline how the beer market works and what's doing really well and what's not?
Sure. So you're right by saying that the dynamics of the category are not as they used to be. That is to say, beer is performing much better than other alcohol categories like spirits or wines or champagnes. It's slightly negative, but not everywhere, and it's just a single-digit negative number. That's to say, the dynamics within beer category are very different, and you may be surprised to hear, but actually premium and the premiumization trend is still there and very pronounced. In fact, there is a sort of a, how do you say that, hour clock, sand clock, or sablier in French, effect. So it grows on the top, it grows on the bottom, and there is a sandwich effect. So actually the mainstream part of the category that's suffering, whereas premium is growing very dynamically and nicely due to many reasons. Also, there's a moderation trend. People drink less, but when they drink, they prefer to choose something more premium and more special. And also kind of wealthy consumers or higher end kind of premium consumers, they are actually not that suffering much from the economic situation overall. So premiumization is still there, and the premium brands are performing pretty well, at least within Carlsberg.
Okay, so within the other alcohols, which, like I said, I know better than I know beer, there's a lot of discussion about which section is going to be under the longest pressure long term. Is it going to be the bottom that falls out, which it probably will in wine, or is it going to be the middle? And how much of this is a structural trend, and how much of it is just simply a cost of living crisis at the moment? What do you foresee for beer?
There is this debate, structural versus cyclical. And as always, the answer, it is probably both. There's a lot of the cyclical effects that we're observing linked to the economic situation and actually consumer confidence index. To be honest, I've just been through some McKinsey reports. The actual economic situation across the world and in Europe as well is not that bad. All the fundamentals of the economies and the disposable income and household disposable income are actually not declining. It's the consumer sentiment that's particularly bad that is impacting the consumption. And that is affecting all the FMCG categories, not just beverages. It's across all, including the shampoos and whatever. In that sense, it will pass. It's truly cyclical. And we also know that where the consumption goes down, which is the young audience mainly, once they enter a certain life stage, when they work, when they have a more disposable income and more social occasions, the consumption goes back clearly to the previous level. So it's a there is a structural element maybe which is linked to the moderation and to the fact that particularly young consumers are very conscious about their health. They treat their bodies as a temple, so they're trying in this dangerous and ambiguous world, they're trying to be in control of what they can be in control, their bodies and health. So they tend to reduce the alcohol consumption. In that sense, it's very important that we have a wide portfolio of non-alcoholic beers and beverages to address and serve them in every occasion.
I have to say, I think the other beverages look at beer with enormous envy, because beer is the only one that has actually managed to make a substitute that tastes as good as the real thing. So what are you seeing in terms of young people and so-called zebra striping or whatever? How do people use these products versus the full-strength alcohol products? What sort of behaviours do you see?
In some situations, they just replace an alcoholic version with a non-alcoholic version of it. And that, well, let's say 10 years ago, they may have been socially a little bit bizarre or unacceptable. Right now, it's totally acceptable socially. They just openly go for a 0.0 version of their preferred brand, and it's totally fine. Sometimes, as you mentioned, there is zebra drinking, so one alcohol drink, one non-alcoholic drink. Sometimes they're mixing as well, so kind of to have a lower ABV drink whilst having some alcohol in it. So there are many ways how they use it. The main kind of fact today is there is a genuine acceptance for the non-alcoholic products. They have significantly stepped up the quality and the product delivery, the taste delivery, and this is a part of the segment that's growing double digit today.
One of the things that's really interesting, if you look at the global story about moderation, is that it's not happening everywhere. It's not necessarily happening in parts of Southeast Asia, for example. It's not necessarily so. The figures that I've seen is in somewhere like Spain, for example, the overall consumption of ethanol is the same. It's just people are substituting beer instead of wine. Of course, at Carlsberg, you see the whole world. What are you seeing in terms of markets? Are there some markets where this just isn't an issue, or is this a truly global phenomenon?
Let's say it's not at the same stage of development. As you say, the more developed markets, the Western European markets, for example, we can see the share of alcoholic-free beers up to 10-15%, like Germany, Spain that you mentioned. So it's and also that works for the favor of the beer overall. Sometimes trading across from wines and spirits to beer is a form of moderation as well in that case. But coming back to beer in Asia, yes, the alcohol-free beer is still a smaller category, but we see all the green shoots and all the consumer trends and insights that tell us that will come there as well. So it's a truly global phenomena, and we're working on the AFB propositions across the world.
So let's go back to Robert Pattinson. I'll just make sure I've covered everything off. On a practical level, just say this. You know, and I hope it works really well. This partnership goes off. How does a partnership like this evolve? Does he and his team get input into the creative? Does he get input if you want to do brand extensions, if you want to or do other collaborations? Like how big can this get, or how constrained is it by who stays in charge?
Well, as I said, he was there from the beginning. His involvement in creating the campaign and inputting to the content of the campaign was vital and very crucial. He was also suggesting some directors he would like to work with. Like we have invited Brady Corbett to do the campaign with us, and whom he has trusted a lot, and he contributed a lot to that. And throughout the process, he will be looking at all the major elements of the campaign, him and his team, and signing off on it. So we will make sure that nothing goes out that he's not aligned with.
Right. And who ultimately is the market for this beer now? Is this for young men? Is it for young men and women? Or is it, if you use somebody who's very dazzling and good looking, it appeals across the market?
So from the category point of view, it's actually, there are two big cohorts. First of all, these are the genuine beer drinkers that would like in some occasions and some elevated occasion to have something special, something new and different. That would be the Blanc product for them, 1664. But also the unique part of the brand is that it appeals to the so-called beer skeptics, those who drink alcohol but very skeptical about beer. We know it for a fact, particularly from the markets where we have a very qualitative shopper panel. This brand has a unique ability to attract new consumers into the beer category. Like market like UK, we see in some cases it was up to 80% of the volumes that came from other categories, from sparkling wines, spirits and alcohol, which is a unique category story, I might say.
I want to hear more about the beer skeptics. Who are the beer skeptics and how do you contact them in the first place? Like, how do you get them to try if they're skeptical about beer?
Well, the beer skeptics are those who kind of have certain preconceptions or insights about beer category that stop them from drinking it, being bloating, being bitter, being too masculine, being like whatever. There are certain barriers we always need to overcome when it comes to beer. And in that sense, a super premium, refined, sophisticated beer with a twist of citrus, with which comes in a super premium blue bottle, kind of breaks all those barriers. And once they try, they buy into it, and then it becomes their product to go to. And that's a very unique role the brand can play for the beer category, for the customers, and overall value creation.
So I guess
journey.
You're talking about female customers there. Would be people like me, I suppose. I don't drink beer very much, but I might be tempted by something like that. Once you get people to overcome that barrier and they try it, do they stay in the category? And if they stay in the category, do they move to other beers? Or is it this particular beer that they like?
They stay in the category, particularly for this proposition, but also they kind of, we break the ice, right? So they've tried the product, which comes from a beer category. In that sense, then they can try other flavored beers if the bitterness is an issue, or they can go further with their exploration journey. So they stay with the category mostly.
Right. So this is like a door opener into the category.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And I did ask you about female consumers. Is this a, I mean, I guess Robert Pattinson has very high appeal to female consumers. Is that also partly why hymned? Because it can bring new people into the category?
It was mainly because of the values he stands for and the perfect fit between the brand and himself and the sense of a good taste and the modern expression of an apologetic good taste. That was the ingoing criteria. That is to say, the brand itself is appealing to women also because of the intrinsics. And hopefully the partnership will fuel this trend going forward.
Okay. So let's just talk briefly about the overall beer category. So we've talked about the fact that the way that people are drinking is changing rapidly. Now, we're talking about young people. There is a view about young people, which is this idea that it's a life stage, that when people get to the life stage, that they will begin spending and drinking like previous people did, and that maybe at the moment it's because they're living at home, they're finding it harder to get on the career ladder and so on. There's another view which says that this particular cohort of younger people is very different from people in the past. They use social media more, they have very different views about health and wellness and so on. So I guess you've already answered the question, but just to go into a bit more depth, do you believe that in the future this sort of Gen Z will look like the older consumers at some point, or do you think that there are some differences about them that the beer market and the wider alcohol market has to take into consideration?
Well, we know for a fact that the reduced alcohol consumption is mostly pronounced amongst the young ones once they enter a certain life stage. I've been reading some research from the alcohol producers that once they start working, the number of drinking occasions multiply, they have a higher kind of disposable income, and they significantly increase their alcohol consumption. That's a fact. So there is a life stage effect to that. That's to say the excessive consumption And irresponsible drinking is diminishing a lot, that's for sure. In that sense, broadening the portfolio of the categories, having non-alcoholic offers and giving them the healthier choices and alternatives will be vital for the categories to survive and for the businesses to evolve.
Okay, so if you look across the beer world, and if you have to predict in the next 10 years, which categories do you think are going to do very well and which categories do you think will do less well than in the past?
Premium will continue doing really well, and everything that carries premium, everything that goes with meaningful cultural role, craftsmanship and creativity, you have to address those three C's, creativity, craft and culture, to be successful within premium. Alcoholic free brands, products and propositions will grow significantly and the offer will be broadening as well. Yeah, that's mainly when it comes to beer, these are little things. Flavored beers as well. We see a lot of growth coming from flavors.
Oh, that's really interesting because I was about to ask you about the role of flavor. So what particular flavors are doing really well and which flavors appeal to which markets?
Oh, that's a good question. You could argue consumers who enter the beer category, their first contact with beverages was for soft drinks. So there's a lot of inspiration that comes from the soft drinks. And so in that sense, citrus flavors, tropical flavors, unexpected flavors that are very present in the soft drinks, they also are taking off within beers. So that's, but then there are geographical differences. Like Asia is one set of flavors. There are salty and spicy flavors.
So, for example, what is the flavor in Southeast Asia? The knock it out of the park flavor.
They are going after surprising combination like sweet and salty, sweet and spicy. All those, particularly it's pronounced in RTD category, ready to drink, canned cocktails category. This is the trend of the moment.
Gosh, that sounds really interesting. Would you consider introducing those flavors into Western markets?
Yeah, of course. Why not? Well, we're opening all the opportunities, yeah.
And what about flavours within the Western markets? What does particularly well? You've said lemon, you've said tropical. Are there other flavours? And actually, what flavours suck? What flavours do you know? Don't put them into beer.
So the flavours that do well, they particularly on the higher end of the range, there's a so-called composite flavors, where it's necessarily not one, but like a combination of the two. There's normally one which is more like a point of parity. It's for consumers easier to relate to, like a citrus or red berries. And then there is another twist that you get to it. Very often it's botanicals or some kind of herbs that give you kind of a premium, unexpected twist. Ginger is very much liked, for
Ginger.
Example, in that sense.
Right. So I guess what all of this is saying is that beer can pose a challenge to RTDs, which is the area of the market which is still doing really well, especially among young people.
Totally. And we are very successful in doing so because RTDs, and mainly the canned cocktails, let's say, for example, when it comes to off-trades, they are going out to after very well-known flavor combination like Jack and Coke and stuff like that. So there is a limited sense of discovery and exploration that exists in this category. That's one thing. Second thing is beer is a naturally brewed product. So there's a genuine kind of built-in naturality and advantages into the beer category as well. So, and we can be much more creative and inventive when it comes to the flavor ranges. In that sense, it's of course a viable competitor to our ready-to-drinks.
Mm, okay. So if you were looking across the whole beverage landscape, who's the big competitor to beer at the moment? So there's RTDs. What are the other competitors? Is it the other alcohols or is it soft drinks or is it just RTDs?
Globally, we're seeing that the share of packaged beverages is increasing. So consumers are prepared to pay. So like there's tap water and then everything that's packaged and there's an extra value to that. They're paying more for the packaged goods. That said, the raw categories are doing extremely well. Today, these are mainly soft drinks. Within soft drinks, these are functional drinks, you know, vitamin waters and energy drinks and overall iced coffees, all around fuel and energy. That's that's doing extremely well. So in that sense, you could argue within a share of pocket, a share of throat fight, these are the main competitors to the beer category.
Okay. All right. So final thoughts. How do you think with all of this competition and people not being, you know, one drinker as they were in the past, how do you think the beer market is going to evolve over the next decade? What do you see ahead?
That's a good question. Well, if I have to decode what the FMCG and CPG players are about to do, you know, because after the COVID, during and after the COVID, there was the spikes of inflation and the revenues were up, but not necessarily the volumes today. So everyone's trying to grow volumes or get back to the healthy growth. And this fight goes through, if I have to decode it, maybe I'm wrong about that. It's all about reframing. So you go from cheese to healthy snacking, from water to healthy hydration, from shaving to skincare. So you try to reframe the battleground. You try to rethink where you play and where you can credibly win in that sense. So, and that I can see across all the categories. So with different degree of success, obviously. So I think beer category has to have a thorough thought about where it credibly can win, being a naturally brewed refreshment drink you can cheer with, an alcohol, with alcohol or without, and design the offer or rethink or reimagine the beer category in that sense. Also embracing all the latest trends, which is convenience, e-commerce, you know, in-home consumption, the shift of on-trade consumption to the chain customers and stuff like that, that triggers new packs, new route to markets, new pricing, all the commercial elements of the equation as well.
I should have asked you, what do you see in terms of the customer journey from zero alcohol into alcohol? Is it a given that they will trade into alcohol, or do you see some people who enjoy the product 0.0 and that's it? They're happy to have just that product. What's the relationship between those two?
Well, I have a theory, and I don't know if it's right or wrong, but it's just that when it comes to alcohol-free beer, you have to ask yourself, when you take alcohol out of it, what is it that stays for consumers? What are the benefits that are still there? So the category is seen as more adult, more social, you can cheer with it. It's refreshing. It's more natural by default. This perception is different depending on the part of the world you're in. Like you have the Mediterranean cluster where the beer is drunk in this aperitivo moment it's a kind of a social adult refreshment drink. And hence Spain has taken the category to 15%, because it's not because of the alcohol, it's basically the ingoing driver is not that. You have some markets where
hang on, you're saying it's the alcohol is not the driver of it. It's the
less
drink.
Of a driver, less of a driver. It's a refreshment natural offer where you can cheer with, and hence you have wider occasion span where you can take this proposition. In some markets, like in the Middle East, malt has a very sacral meaning. It's like malt is the grain is a source of life, and hence malt-based propositions are flourishing as well, like mousses being one of them in our portfolio. In Africa, grains and malt is known for its nutritional value. Moms are giving malt drinks to their kids to school. You have Malta, Maltina, and all those propositions or drinks, malt-based drinks, deriving from this.
Gosh.
So, you see, so it's if we need to design a global FB strategy, you have to look how the intrinsics of the category are perceived across the world and build on that. And you can come up with very different ideas how you build this category and what your innovation pipeline should be, and branding as well. And then what it comes with that is the route to market, the value chain, how you hit the pricing and the margins against soft drinks, so it becomes a compelling offer for the customers and consumers as well.
All right, those are all my questions. And thank you for telling me so much about. I feel like I know a lot more about beer than I did when I started the conversation.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
And so final thoughts about the category and where you expect the category of premium beer to go in the future.
Well, as I said, premiumization trend is still there. It's present. It's actually present across all beverages nearly, except for energy drinks. Within energy, there are lots of local players that are undercutting in pricing, so structurally there isn't any premium trend, whilst the category is still very dynamic. Within beer, premium is growing much faster than the average category, and I think this trend will be accelerating even further. So in that sense, the outlook is pretty bright.
Great. All right. Well, look, thank you so much for your time this morning. And like I said, I've learned a lot.
I'm happy to hear that. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.